Hi, my name is George Jallo, and I'm an associate professor of pediatrics and neurosurgery here at Johns Hopkins.
And I'm Elizabeth Tracy, and we're talking today about hydrocephalus. Kind of a big word. Let's break it down and say what it really means.
It actually comes from the Greek hydro, which is water, and cephalus, brain. It's not really water on the brain. It's really the accumulation of cerebrospinal fluid in the ventricles or the fluid-filled spaces of the children's brain. I look at the brain as being in a box. In that box, we have brain tissue. We have the cerebrospinal fluid, which is inside the brain as well as on the outside, and it serves three functions. One, it's a cushion. And then the other thing that it provides is it provides nutrients to the brain, and it also takes away the nutrients of the brain. The final part of what it may do is it allows the pressure to be equal between the brain and the spinal cord itself.
And actually, the cerebrospinal fluid, or what most people refer to as CSF, and maybe we could start talking about it that way, also turns over quite a bit. It's not static. It doesn't just sit there.
Yes. It's not as if we just have a certain volume in our brains. Let's take an adult. A typical adult has maybe 100 cc's, so about half a cup of fluid in the brain. But that is being turned over constantly, and the average adult or even a young adolescent will make about 500 cc's, which is about a soda can plus of fluid every day. So what we make has to be able to be dissolved and reabsorbed by our brains. And that's where we go into why some children have hydrocephalus.
So in most people, then, there's a constant turnover and there's a place where this cerebrospinal fluid gets resorbed, but not when people develop hydrocephalus.
Correct. There are many different forms of hydrocephalus. Some children make too much and can't reabsorb it, and thus that fluid's going to accumulate. And what happens is, as I said, if our heads are in a box, if that fluid's accumulating and expanding, something else has to give. And that's the brain that's being compressed and more pressure. And sometimes it actually shrinks in these young children.
Clearly, this is a really serious problem, because not only does it compromise the brain's development, which continues after birth, but could ultimately kill someone, it sounds like.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, shunts didn't come into existence until the 1950s or 1960s. So there were all these children prior to the advent of shunts, when we were starting to treat hydrocephalus, that were dying because their heads expanded so much that parents or their caretakers couldn't take care of them, and they finally succumbed to that pressure inside their brain.
How often does this problem take place, and what exactly is the problem when there's hydrocephalus?
One in 500 or one in 1,000 children will have some form of hydrocephalus, and there are many forms of hydrocephalus. I break it down to, simplistically, two forms. There's the acquired form, where a young child or a young adult develops hydrocephalus as they're getting older because there's a block at some level in the fluid-filled spaces of the brain, whether it be a brain tumor, a bleed, or a hemorrhage from one sort of trauma or some other inflammatory process. The other form is congenital. Children are born with hydrocephalus. And the reasons they may be born with hydrocephalus are several-fold. They also may have blood during the birthing process, especially if they're born slightly premature. And that somehow blocks the absorption capabilities of that child, and then they develop hydrocephalus.
Okay, serious problem, lots more common than we thought. What can parents do, or how would they even suspect that there might be a problem?
If you have a young infant where their skull is still very soft and their sutures haven't closed, that child will present with an increasing head size and a dramatically increasing head size. The other sign that children may have, or young infants, they may be sleepy, they may have vomiting, and not just spit up after their feeds, it's projectile vomiting where the vomit, you know, may go from the child's mouth to the ceiling. The other finding is that the child can't look up. I mean, we call that sunsetting eyes in these infants, where if you look at them, at their eyes are looking down towards their feet, and they just can't seem to look up towards the sky or the ceiling. And that's a classic finding. The other is, you know, these children, their soft spot, their fontanelle hasn't closed. If that feels tense or bulging up, that's always a suspicion that there's a suspected hydrocephalus. Now, in older children where their skulls are closed, the soft spots closed, it's a little more difficult. These children may present with some subtle findings such as blurred vision, headaches, and you know, children do complain of headaches. And the one thing we should recognize is that headaches aren't that common in children. So if a child complains of a significant headache every day with associated vomiting, you know, parents should be suspicious for hydrocephalus.
Okay, so now we have a suspicion. We're going to come in and see you. What do you do to diagnose it? And then let's talk about fixing the problem.
Correct. I mean, diagnosis is simple. We need to do an imaging study. In the young children where the soft spot hasn't closed, we can do a simple test as an ultrasound. The other test, a little more sensitive, is a CAT scan, and it's a simple test. It may take 5 to 10 seconds today, and it looks at the brain, and it also looks at the fluid-filled ventricles, and we can tell immediately whether or not there is hydrocephalus. And finally, the most sensitive of studies is the MRI scan. In older children where they'll sit still, and we need them to sit still for about 40 minutes or maybe even an hour, we can do the MRI scan.
Okay, so now we have a diagnosis. We know it's hydrocephalus. Then what?
The way we treat it is simple. We just have to divert the fluid from the brain to some other place, whether it be the abdomen, in the heart, or in the lung. There are many places where we can drain this fluid. And the way we drain it is through these sialastic tubes. And all it is, it takes two small incisions, one in the head where we place the catheter in the ventricle, and then we run the tubing under the skin, and we make another small incision and insert it into the cavity that's going to receive it, typically the abdominal cavity.
Sounds great, but what are the risks of surgery?
I mean, the risks are small. The procedure itself is a very simple procedure. It's relatively short to complete the procedure. The biggest risks are infection. As in any operation that we do, there is a risk of infection. The problem with an infection in a child that has a hydrocephalus and a shunt is if that tubing gets infected, we have to take it out and treat with antibiotics for a prolonged period of time, and then return that child back to the operating room and replace it with a complete new system. Now, the advances that we have here is that we have catheters that have antibiotics in them directly. So it's lessened our infection rate. What used to be 10%, 1 in 10 shunts getting infected, now we've brought that down to 1 or 2 in 100.
But how long does that last? Is it ultimately going to have to be replaced at some point?
The drugs last for about a month, but that's all we need them to last, because if that child's going to develop an infection, it typically is early. It's going to occur within the first several months. Just having the drug there present for a month decreases the infection rate. The other problem with these shunts is it's like plumbing in a house or tubing or wiring in a house. It's prone to malfunction for many reasons. One could be debris can fill the tubing, and they're really small. Even in young children, you don't see them under their skin. They're probably about the size of a pen head or a pencil head. So any little debris, any little fluid that can obstruct it may obstruct it and cause a malfunction. And in those cases, we have to replace what's not working.
How often is replacement necessary?
Some children, never. Other children, you may have to replace it every other week or every other month. The average lifespan of a shunt's only 5 years, and that's looking at all comers, all children that have these shunts in place. So it's not a single procedure that's done for the rest of their lives.
What about hydrocephalus just as a condition? Do children ultimately outgrow it? They won't need a shunt at some point in their life?
I think every parent asks that. Will my child outgrow the hydrocephalus? Most likely, no. There is a small percentage of children that may, but majority of the time, once they have a shunt, they're going to be shunt dependent for the rest of their lives.
But even so, it's better than the alternative.
Correct. These children, prior to the advent of shunts, were dying. So we've been able to treat them. These children can lead normal existences, normal everyday activities. They can play sports, place very, if any, restrictions on these children.
Finally, I guess I'd like to ask you, is the procedure for placing a shunt the same regardless of the genesis of the need for a shunt?
Yes. Regardless of what the cause is, a shunt operation's the same all across the board.
And it sounds like it has a great outcome.
Absolutely. I think we've done wonders for these children with hydrocephalus.